Today I'm in Bristol, right by the harbour, with Jerry Gilpin. And I've not been down here for years. And of course they've changed it all since I was last here.
That's what they do.
The first question is, when and where did we first meet?
Well, I should have looked at my record, shouldn't I? But we first met in your study, your rectory. And that would be about 5 years ago, I think, probably, wouldn't it?
It might even be six.
Yeah. So I was very impressed to drive down the drive and sweep round the gravel like a Jane Austen carriage in my little car to park in Box Vicarage. So yes, I remember it very well.
Mm. Next question is, do you drink tea?
I do drink tea, but as we were saying as we got ready for this, it feels wrong to be drinking at 12 o'clock. 12 o'clock is not the tea time. Tea kind of finishes at about late breakfast of 9 o'clock, and then it starts again at 3 in the afternoon. So it's a huge sacrifice I'm making now that I'm not drinking coffee rather than tea at this particular point in the day, although I very much like tea.
Right. Yes, and do you have a favourite sort of tea?
I think probably this one, just the old English breakfast. I like Assam. Occasionally I like something like jasmine, just to be more kind of floral and light and stuff. Not a big favour of lapsang, and I don't like green tea, it's too bitter. But this is fine. I'm not very demanding about my tea. As long as it's not too weak and milky, don't like it then. There's got to be some colour to it.
Yeah, I'm not going to ask you what's the worst cup of tea you ever had.
Well, it wasn't at your house.
That's a very political question answer, wasn't it?
I'm wondering where it was. I can tell you where it was. So many years ago, it was when I was still at school, and it was at my friend Brian's house, and his mother made tea, which was about a third milk.
Right.
It was just disgusting. I had to drink it because you have to when you're polite, when you're 14 or whatever I was at the time, but no, horrible.
Mm. So question I'm asking everybody is, how do you respond to the statement Christianity in the UK is dying, not dying, but sleeping?
I was pondering that this morning and wondering how I did respond to it, and I think obviously there's a big difference between dying and sleeping, and there's a big difference between being asleep and being dead. The way I responded to it, which is not probably the best way, because they always say don't criticise the question, don't they, in an exam, but I'm not sure there's such a thing as Christianity in that sense, in that institutional sense. So I think it's quite hard to say whether Christianity is dying or sleeping or living or turning cartwheels or whatever. I think there are churches that are dying. There are churches that are sleeping. There are churches that are growing. There are churches and communities which are flourishing. So I don't, even though my general preference in terms of the way I think about the world is to look at the big picture, it didn't really resonate with me to be making a kind of really overall big picture judgment about Christianity. I think it's clearly, there's less signs of, there's less institutional numbers than there was a century ago. So that looks like decline, but I think maybe some of the life that is emerging in particular contexts and places is actually more valuable than a lot of moribund, not very muchness.
I mean, the quote isn't mine. Tim Stanley, who wrote an article about it in The Telegraph.
Right.
18 months ago, maybe 2 years ago.
Right.
And the reason why I picked on it is because I didn't know what I thought about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I normally know what I think about things, yes. So the fact that I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because, and our context, last year was the first year in one of our villages where we had more weekday attendances at our regular things than Sundays. In the other place, other parish, we had more attendances at our non-Sunday mornings than Sunday mornings.
Yes, yeah.
So either Sunday afternoons or the stuff that we're doing in the week.
I think that, I mean, yeah, and what that speaks to is the fact that patterns are changing, aren't they? And that and the church, and churches, the church as an institution has to be flexible and adaptable in ways that for centuries it never seemed to have to be because the pace of change in society was so much slower. So I think, yeah, there are places where the church is adapting really well and, you know, is finding ways of flourishing and preserving and enhancing and presenting faith in new ways. And then there are places which haven't kind of got off the bus. Is that the right? That's probably not the right phrase, but that sense of, you know, being the same old, and then I think it looks in those situations. If all you looked at was those churches, you would say, "Well, it's dying." But that to me, that doesn't really matter. If those things die, that doesn't mean to say faith is dying.
Next question. Mm. If you could change one thing about the Church of England, what would it be?
Well, I know that, again, this is special pleading, really, but I think I would change some of its history, which, of course, is just impossible to do. But I would change, if I could, I would change that sense of it being as integral to for a long time to the self-understanding of what it meant to be English. And therefore, if you were going to preserve a sense of Englishness and national identity, the knock-on effect of that is you can't change anything about the church. So we had whatever it was, 350 years of the Book of Common Prayer, which is a fantastic document. I mean, you know, I love it as an English graduate at one level, but it simply, you know, for hundreds of years it wasn't fit for purpose because there was this sense that actually we were sort of legislated into a situation of stasis. And that, I think, has meant that it's only been in the last 30 years, perhaps, that the church, 40 years maybe, that the church has actually had to get used to the fact that change is happening very fast and that it needs to change. And the church should always have been at the cutting edge of change, and it's not. It's way at the back all the time now. But I think that's the product of history. So if there was one thing I could change, it would be about... It would be, I mean, maybe it would be actually when you, I'm talking myself into this, maybe it would be establishment actually. Maybe it would be that, but way back, you know, it's not like, I don't think it would actually achieve very much to disestablish now, but having ever been established, that might have meant that we were in a different position now because the church, and being slightly outside society, outside the norms and structures of society, might have got more familiar with change. I'm more comfortable with change and having to be a bit more prophetic, if that's the right word. Whereas, you know, for many centuries that wasn't really seen to be its role. It was seen to be a glue. And you don't want to take the glue out of a structure because otherwise everything falls down. So
it's really interesting. I think one of the things I'm quite curious about is Methodism. And sometimes I feel quite judgmental about Methodists because it seems to me in a way that they created a really, really important, vibrant, culturally relevant expression of church for when they were founded.
Yeah, yeah.
And they did all the things that they did and that they were involved with were really important for around the time of their foundation.
Yeah.
And they've stayed there.
Yeah, and this is a natural human thing. That's what we do, isn't it? We, as we get older... He says, getting older himself, you know, we get tired of change. We want to know there are things we can rely on, and institutions, you know, you can look at any kind of organization has its period of sort of entrepreneurial growth and then stasis, and it has to change and become something else, you know. And then now you're looking, I mean, this morning in the news, House of Fraser closing stores all over the place, Marks and Spencer's not giving them bonuses to their senior managers. So you've got there's a particular kind of organisation there that has been static and expects to have a place in the market for a very long time. And now it comes hard to find that actually we're not buying stuff in the same way. So, I think that, but that's what we do, you know. We like to make something we think will last, see in our buildings as well, can't you? You know, that we, you know, we value the stuff that that lasts through the centuries. We like that, that sense of stability, of keeping out disorder and so on. But actually, maybe we just try too hard and we don't accept the flux of life in the way that we should do.
My next question is one which was carefully thought about for you and is a truly individual question.
So privileged.
Because some of the others, actually the next two questions are just for you, Jeremy.
Well, thank you so much, Jenny.
What do you think is the key to successful, what do you think is the key to successful exit from full-time stipendiary ministry, which obviously you have done?
Yes. I was thinking about that question. I think in short, the answer is knowing what else you want to go to. And having a sense of, as a Christian, unless you're exiting stipendary ministry because you've just suddenly had an atheist bombshell has landed on your house kind of thing. If you're exiting from a particular form of ministry, I think it really helps to feel called to something else. And that's, so that for me, that was very much the case, of feeling called at one, from teaching into ordained Christian ministry, and then from parish into chaplaincy, and then from chaplaincy into the coaching that I'm doing now. So each of them, well, particularly this last step, 10 years ago or 11 years ago, nearly now, may look like quite a radical departure. But for me, the sense of vocation has still been the same, because I still feel I'm, on a good day anyway, I contribute to human flourishing and growth, and therefore to God's purpose for people. So I think that's very different from leaving full-time ministry because you just get fed up with it. That wasn't the way that it felt to me. I think leaving anything is difficult on that basis, though. I think a sort of negative leaving is always hard. And as I get older, and obviously, I've got friends who are retiring from standard working life. The questions arise around that as well. Well, how do you leave working life? What does that actually mean? And I think there too, you need to have a sense of what's coming next, and as a positive choice. Because otherwise you're just left with a vacuum.
I guess I know a lot of people who've exited ministry from a real position of brokenness. And there are still really long and important debates to have about why parish ministry seems to break so many ordained people.
Yes, yeah.
And to not be possible, what we're asking people to do does not seem possible for a large number of them to do.
Yeah.
But there is also a sense of not being able, what can you then do? And I think that's a really difficult question for people.
It is. And I think, I suppose the sort of functional answer to your question is, actually, it's easiest if you're still drawing on many of the same skills, which I kind of am. But then that's equally true with any career transition. So there are people that are broken by being teachers or being doctors. And in order to make a successful transition, they need enough degree of self-confidence about the next thing they're going into, that in the sense that it's going to draw on skills and abilities and attributes that they have, because it's extremely difficult in midlife to suddenly branch off and learn a whole new set of skills. It kind of feels like it's too late. So I think that sense of calling into the next thing, I think that's a separate question, to be honest, to why is Church of England ministry sometimes so damaging. And I think that's to do with trying to operate, essentially trying to operate a Christendom model of ministry in an environment that's completely changed. So you're trying to be sort of George Herbert, if you like, you know, kind of visiting and, you know, making this relation, having a really sort of stable set of relationships and sort of stable heart of ministry in a particular place, in a situation which is completely changed because of the amount of bureaucracy behind it, because of the number of expectations that are placed upon you, which would never have. I mean, the world was just so much smaller when that kind of ministry was successful, and the people that I know that do feel really, I say comfortable in parish. You never feel comfortable in parish ministry, but people who feel fulfilled and energized by parish ministry, actually, what they've ended up doing is, to some degree, I think, rejecting some of the demands that are made on them, and they've been firm. They've been able to hold their own shape and say, "No, these few things are what I'm going to do," and they manage their boundaries very well.
Mm-hmm.
But the expectation of the sort of, you know, poor old George Herbert, I've got a lot of respect for him, so I'm criticising that, because I think at that time that was a really helpful model of ministry. But the expectation there is that you'll know everybody and you'll be able to meet all the needs. But the needs, that's all the needs of like 1,000 people, all the spiritual needs of 1,000 people. That's still doable if you had that situation, but that situation is just never going to arise again.
So I do the job that 30 years ago, three men full-time were employed to do, who also had other people managing their household.
Yeah, exactly.
And driving and technology make it possible. I'm not sure they make it healthy.
No, they don't.
In the same way.
No.
And that's the...
And also driving and technology mean that the task is bigger.
Mm.
Because you can theoretically go from, you know, Box to Cologne or wherever it is, whereas if you're going to spend half a day riding there, that's not going to be practical, is it?
No. So, no, I certainly couldn't do a 9:30 service at Cologne and a 10:30 service at Box if I had a horse.
Yeah. No,
it wouldn't work.
No, exactly. Exactly.
I don't do it very often, but there are times I do go from one to the other.
Yeah. When I was in parish ministry, I most Sundays I did 9:30 and 11:15 in two parishes that were about 5 miles apart. So yeah, you can do it, but it doesn't make for good relationships, particularly not in the first parish, because you're rushing off. Bye.
I think that leads quite neatly onto our next question, which is, what would be the one piece of work practice that you think it would benefit every clergy person to follow?
Well, this isn't going to be very exciting at one level, I don't think. I read a book recently which has had mixed reviews, and for good reason, because some of its gender politics is a bit old-fashioned, shall we say. But it's a book called 12 Rules for Life, the second of which is something like, treat yourself as if you were somebody you were responsible for, or responsible for helping. That's it, I think. And it seems to me that is the most important thing that we can do as human beings, actually, but particularly clergy in ministry tend not to do, because the focus is so much on facilitating the community, helping the individuals around them, the focus is always outward, it's always into the sort of extrovert world, if you'd like to frame it that way, but actually, unless we're looking at ourselves and managing ourselves, we're never going to be even faced with the questions about how we steward our energy and our resources and our family life and the relationships that matter to us, and the reason that we don't do that is we think that our responsibility is to treat other people as people we're responsible for. But it's a bit like the thing in the airplane, isn't it? You always put your own oxygen mask on first, and for all sorts of good reasons. So I'm not critical of anybody that doesn't do this, because I think the pressures are all in that, are all in the wrong direction culturally. But for all sorts of good reasons, clergy tend not to feel they should be doing that. They think that's selfish, or they think it's limiting the grace of God in some way, or shutting off the opportunities for ministry and for people to hear the gospel, or to be renewed by the Eucharist, or, you know, however they particularly frame it given their theology. But actually, unless you're embodying, incarnating a good human way of living, then you're not necessarily modelling anything that you would want really to be sharing with people anyway. So so there's, you know, there's good ministry reasons, external reasons, if you like, for managing yourself better. So that would be the one thing. But then I would, that's probably advice or I would give anybody in any role.
Mm. The roundup question is, what is your favourite thing beginning with T?
I found that really hard. I find it the hardest question. I don't know whether lots of your interviewees do. So I was kind of looking around, I think, the television, oh no, not really. You know, I kind of want to watch telly occasionally. In the end, I came down to three people called Timothy. So I have two very good friends and a brother who are all called Tim. And there's certainly no object that I could think of beginning with T that enriches my life anywhere near as much as any of them. So unusually for me, because I do like things, you know, I'm quite materialistic in that sense, but unusually for me, I'm going to go for people, right? So the three Tims. Yeah,
there's lots of T's in that. That's good.
Yeah,
that's a very good one. So thank you very much for seeing me today, Jerry.
It's been a pleasure. It's great to see you in a different context.